could come back 3-4 days later, harvest it again. I could do this like 4 or 5 times. And then I could keep harvesting the rice from that area. The Ojibwa people, what they would do is sometimes the women would actually take grass stems and tie them into like a question mark shape. And then all they had to do was come up to that cluster head and tap it so they weren't having to bend. Because I've done wild racing. Have any of you raced before? No. Your arms get tired from flailing all day long. This is all you're doing. Swish, bam, bam. Swish, bam, bam. Swish, bam, bam. Swish, bam, bam. And your arms get really tired. You can feel the weight of these. They're very lightweight, but still, it's that motion. Your arms get very tired. And the push-pull person, you're usually moving through fairly quickly as you're going through a site, because the faster you do it, the faster you can get your racing done. You'll see the grains, how they land in the bag is how they land in a canoe. The grain head will all point in one direction with the barb or on pointing up, and they will drive down into the muck on the bottom. When you're canoeing, and if you get a really good canoe full, they call it the old man's beard, because all those barb ons point in one direction, so it looks like a man's beard hanging down, which is really kind of cool.
Question.
Yes.
That sword in your backpack, is that real? I mean, staying at a picture.
We'll learn more about that. No, it's not. Mm-hmm. But we'll learn more about that at our final stop. But one other, yes, they're just my props. So this is the wild rice bra, and then the finished product. You can pass those around if you want to look at it. Not only did they harvest wild rice in this area, but I had the question, we were talking about the addle, the spear thrower. Now it's from people 8,000 years ago hunting a 3,000 pound animal. We're now in the pine forest ecosystem 3,000 years ago. Forest changed. We have smaller animals. We have moose, we have elk, and we have white-tailed deer. The addle doesn't work so well on a white-tailed deer, does it? Who's ever gone hunting for a white-tailed deer, even just to take a picture of it? They move very fast. They're very aware of your presence. We probably have deer watching us, because there actually is a doe in her fawns that lives right here. She's always here. We just can't see her. And an addle wouldn't work in this brush, would it? No. So this is when the bow and arrow makes its appearance. And this one right here, this one with the broken cleft area where they would fasten it to a stick, this was actually a replica taken out of one of the mounds here at this site. But you can see the difference between that and this gray one is a replica of a deer head from the addles at the Bison Hill site. Totally different in size. This here, this black piece of stone with the curve. Anybody know what that is? That was also taken from the Bison Kill site.
Spears.
For fleshing.
Yes. Oh, it's scrapers. The hide scraper.
The hide.
It's the flesher and mm-hmm. hide scraper. And actually, if I didn't have this piece in here, I can't take it out because it is still even a replica. It's razor sharp. It's curved to fit the fashion of the hand. And this one is curved for a right hand. So the person is right handed while they were holding it. Because when you try and hold it in your left hand, it doesn't work.
Do you hear that, Mary? The right hand is
And so when you actually hold this one, it's like it's for the right hand. When we try to hold it in the left hand, the blade goes the wrong way.
Yeah.
Unless they do something funky with their arm on the left hand. But this stone is the most amazing thing. This was found here at Nikolai Creek. But that is obsidian. The closest place you're going to find obsidian is at Yellowstone National Park. So people always think 8,000 years ago, people were pretty restricted on where they lived and what they had. That is proof that there was trade going on, that things were trading thousands of miles away. And even evidence of Minnesota wild rice was found in other states. And what's kind of cool with these birch bark macaques, in the Boundary Waters canoe area, there are a lot of rock cliffs. And they found a macaque. And when they analyzed the rice in it, it was over 100 years old. Somebody had hid it in this crack. They might have died or forgot about it, never came back, and the rice was still perfectly preserved. You could have ate it.
How old was it?
Over 100 years old.
Oh, nice.
It was a macaque, a birch bark macaque, hidden in a crevice, in a rock formation, back then, people didn't have state boundaries. Mm-hmm. Not like today. That's more of a European-American concept. It's the white people. When I say European-American, it's white people. White people isn't color of skin, though. White people are from anywhere else that's not North America. Because we had slaves that were brought here, and they were called white. Because to the African, or to the Indians that lived here, white wasn't a color. White was Indian or non-Indian. And if you were called white, you could have been from Asia, you could have been from Africa, you could have been from Europe, you could have been a Pacific Islander, you would have been white or Indian. And George Bonga is related to this piece of material I have here. Because the connection of our Indian cultures, when changes began happening dramatically, these communities were very small. It was only maybe 15 people, because you can only pick so many berries in an area. So there were a lot of small villages, but they were quite small. Things began changing when European Americans came. And when they came, they were looking for gold and silver and other things. And one thing that started connecting the Indian community with the bigger world was this. And this is the beaver. And it was because of fashion. And if you ever read the book Alice in Wonderland, who's read Alice in Wonderland?
The book?
You know who the Mad Hatter is? Mm-hmm. The Mad Hatter was the bourgeois. He was the owner of the fur trade company. And in Lewis Carroll's book, he makes fun of them. And they call him the Mad Hatter because the bourgeois wore the big top hats made out of beaver felt. They did not want the guard hairs. They wanted that thick under fur. And they would process that into felt. But do you know how they made felt? They used a certain chemical, which you cannot touch with your bare hands. We don't even have thermometers made with those anymore. They use mercury. And the guys in the hat industry would handle mercury with their bare hands. They died fairly quickly. It was not a long-term career for you making hats.
It's why they called them the Mad Hatters.
But the Mad Hatter was the bourgeois. You never could fully extract all the mercury out of the felt. And so the Mad Hatter, he would be wearing his nice top hat. And slowly, 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 mercury leached into his brain, where his hat band was. And so slowly, 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 in books back then, they called it eccentric. But basically, they went mad. And I thought, isn't nature funny? How nature got its comeuppance by the people killing animals for the fur industry. And then slowly, the process to make the felt killed them from their greed for making this. And actually, when they had done research, most beaver had been extirpated from Europe. They had already been extracted from that region of the world for clothing industry. And when the fur trade, when explorers came here and they discovered this whole new abundance, that's why people began divvying up this country and claiming it for themselves, for Spain, England, France, because they wanted the money. Show me the money. Here's the money. It just doesn't fit in your wallet very well. And what we're going to do is we're going to wrap up right near the headwaters. I'm going to tell that story of the explorers and how they impacted the settlement of our nation and Itasca. And we'll let you guys go and play and explore. I'm sorry it's taking a little long to get to that point. We'll just get this all shoved in here. And in about 5 minutes, we'll be right down near the headwaters.
I want to say pre-Renaissance, but I think I'm wrong.
They actually were trapping for, I mean, fisher, bobcat, buffalo hides. I mean, with the buffalo, that's the whole story of their extinction, is because they wanted the hides. And when they traveled, the cool thing is Itasca actually became a site where we began restoring animal species that had been removed.
Are
and buffalo
with beavers now?
With beavers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you get that help?
We actually get these from the Minnesota Trappers Association because we are an education facility. They usually donate them to us. But the Minnesota Trappers Association can provide help. But as an educational institution, they have given them to us at like a discounted rate. Oh, yeah, you can get some beautiful pelts. And then we tell them too sometimes for if they're having to do special trapping to remove nuisance animals, we'll tell them like if we need a certain pelt, like a summer pelt or something, and then if they're doing nuisance trapping, save that pelt for us.
When the Europeans came here, when the Europeans came to Itasca, was this village still inhabited?
Not this site. There actually were, there was activity at the, there was a site by Elk Lake. And when Schoolcraft came here in 1832, the village site was not occupied. The people had moved on to somewhere else, but there was evidence they had been there. And then a young man who read Schoolcraft's journal, very wealthy young man, he didn't have to work. And in 1834, when he came and followed Schoolcraft out, it was earlier in the summer, in June, and he did actually see the Indians in camp on Elk Lake.
Is it known because trappers in the 17th and 18th century, there's some records of the quantity of the pelts?
Oh, yeah, so there's.
Of accounts, so is it known if Native Americans here were trapping from the Europeans?
Yes, they were, and I'll share that at our last stop.
Okay, because I'm sure people are curious about the contact of the first contact and what that was like and how that worked out.
Oh, yeah, and it's actually quite interesting. Many of these explorers married women from the Indian villages, and so they ended up having children, and sometimes these children then became guides for other explorers, and it was actually a very close-knit cult. It's interesting because you have to have the spirit of somebody who doesn't mind going into unexplored areas. And you have to have the spirit of having what I call restless feet. And a lot of these explorers were that way, and they just couldn't settle down. And one journal, Alexander the Younger, his father was actually at a fur post up at Hudson Lake, but Alexander the Younger was stationed near Grand Forks. And he was there for less than a year, and he was like, oh, well, in his journal, you can actually read it, it's online.
Alexander's would have been Scotsman,
no? You know, I can't recall. I think they were. and the concern of if that went global, and you know, there's just so many things that with our rapid movement, but even back then, you know, when schoolcraft was coming across, you had a month trip in a ship coming across to England, but it was still long enough for people to be carrying these, and a lot of Europeans had already developed immunity, so maybe you would get sick from like chicken pox, but you wouldn't die. But the Indians who had no immunity, I mean, it was just devastating.
I've heard about the ships also being a bit of a petri dish, right? Like, so if somebody had one, like everybody had everything by the time they got off the boat.
Oh, yeah.
And so they would just inoculate.
Sure,
you know, so when they talk about germ warfare, unfortunately, it was already a concept when people were settling this country. That they were giving Indians blankets during the Sioux Uprising in 1862. They were giving Indians blankets that were infested with smallpox and measles and mumps and hoping to get rid of them. So it's really tragic. Discovers this new land that he names after the king of tribes that lived in those regions. And people will oftentimes say, well, Connie, you know, the Mississippi River, why isn't it the Missouri? That's longer. Or the Ohio, because that has more surface flow and volume. And the reason is because we don't go by mathematical calculations. We respect the names the cultures had given them, because each one of those rivers is named after that tribe that lived at the outlet of that river and claimed that land for their home range. So the Missouri Indians lived at the outlet of the Missouri River. They named that river and its basin the Missouri River after the people. So it's the Missouri people's land and river. The Ohio or the Oyo Indians lived on that river. They named it after themselves. And the Mississippi where we are now was called the Gichizibi with a G sound. Gichizibi, which means the great river spread over a large area. It's an Algonquian dialect, which would be the Cree and the Ojibwa people. Mm. Cree actually were in this area closer to the time of the Woodland people. And so it had many names, but Mississippi or Gichizibi is this coarse channel named by the Algonquian people, dialect people. And so when the explorers came, I say, I commend them because they didn't name it after themselves. They kept the original Indian names, which identified the people and their homelands. And they didn't change it because, well, we found the Missouri is longer, so let's call that the beginning of the Mississippi. Or we found the Ohio has bigger volume, let's call that the beginning. They didn't retain it based on mathematical measurements. They kept it more as a social, the societal naming of the river systems. And when you actually, Reverend Gilfillan was commissioned to take name data along the Mississippi River in Minnesota in 1910. He was a minister for the White Earth Indians on the White Earth Indian Reservation, and he was recording place names. And it is amazing because, yes, they called this the Gichizibi, but they also had place names on the river because they traveled by canoe. This was their